concession.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. The next case on the court's calendar is Aparicio versus State. I hope I pronounced his name correctly. Case number 80072. Are you ready to proceed on behalf of Mr. Aparicio?
Yes, Your Honors.
Okay. Please proceed.
Just for inquiry, Your Honors, will the Mr. Aparicio be presenting first, or will the State of Nevada be presenting first?
The appellant.
Yes, of course. Have you divided any time with the Nevada Association of Criminal Justice?
Your Honor, per the order, it appears that there would be 15 minutes for the appellant, 5 minutes for the amicus, and 15 minutes plus 5 minutes in rebuttal in response to the State, Your Honors.
Okay, we'll proceed with that schedule.
Yes, Your Honors, with the court's permission, if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal on behalf of Mr. Aparicio as well.
Okay, that's included in your time, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you, Your Honors, for allowing me to present before you today this case. This case presents two primary issues per the Supreme Court's docket summary. One, whether all of the victim impact letters fall under the broader definition of victim as set forth in Marcy's Law, and two, whether the Court of Appeals properly concluded that the district court's error was not harmless in admitting letters in this particular matter. While the second question is more of an interpretation of the Court of Appeals decisions, the first seems to be a question of first impression before the State. Respectfully, Mr. Aparicio, as he reads the question, would state to the court that for the reasons that I'm about to cite, it is the belief of Mr. Aparicio that Marcy's Law does not set forth a broader definition than that which is already depicted in NRS 176.015. Specifically, NRS 176.015, Section 5, Subsection D, specifically states that a victim includes a person, including a governmental entity against whom a crime has been committed, a person who has been injured or killed as a direct result of the commission of a crime, and a relative of a person described in subparagraphs 1 or 2. A relative is defined as a spouse, parent, grandparent, or stepparent, a natural-born child, stepchild or adopted child, a grandchild, brother, sister, half-brother or half-sister, or parent of the spouse. With regards to Marcy's Law, Section 8A of the Nevada Constitution specifically states, as used in this section, victim means any person directly and proximately harmed by the commission of a criminal offense under any law of this state. It further goes on to indicate that if a victim is less than 18 years of age, incompetent, incapacitated, or deceased, it also includes a legal guardian of the victim or a representative of the victim's estate, member of the victim's family, or any other person who was appointed by the court to act on behalf of victim's behalf. In this particular case, the State brings this forth on a petition for review of the Court of Appeals ruling that there are two classes of individuals in Mr. Aparicio's specific case who gave statements, one from victims as defined under the Nevada Revised Statute and defined under the Section 8A of the Nevada Constitution, and non-victims who fall within a catch-all provision of NRS 176.015 that allows the district court the authority to consider any reliable and relevant evidence at the time of sentencing. And that would be the catch-all dealing with situations in non-victims. In this particular case, there were 50 letters approximately to be presented to the court for review, of which the defense objected to 46 as being not relevant or not falling within the definition of a victim. In ruling that all of those letters were considered in their entirety, the district court ruled that Marcy's law, it specifically required that she assess all of the letters as any person being affected by the crime would fit within the definition of victim under Marcy's law. For the following reasons, I put forth that that is an incorrect assertion. Specifically, looking at Marcy's law itself, it can be gleaned by this court that the Court of Appeals decision holding that there are different classes of individuals, victim and non-victim, who give statements at sentencing to be true. The state would ask this court to include anybody who has been proximately impacted versus directly approximately impacted be defined as a victim. However, Marcy's law's text in and of itself specifically gives the court guidance as to why that's not the case. Specifically looking at Marcy's law, section 1, it indicates that each person who is the victim of a crime is entitled to the following rights. In subsection C, it indicates to have the safety of the victim and the victim's family considered as a factor in fixing the amount of bail and the release conditions for the defendant. This is language that makes it clear that a victim and a victim's family are to be considered individually as victims. It lends credibility to the proposition that those outside the victim's family do not fit within there. If you were to adopt a proximate situation, then you would be opening the door to allow a large number of people to be considered victims. This is also
so. For example, let me just pause you here. You have a wide array of letters in this case, and you have one, or more than one, but from the Krista's co-worker. She was an oncology nurse and was apparently an emotional mainstay for her patients and co-workers at the hospital. And that's expressed in some of these letters, that her losing her materially changed the relationship with her coworkers and maybe even a patient, I don't know. Would that qualify as directly and proximately harmed in your estimation under Marcy's law?
Respectfully, I would cite that it does not. I would cite that it could potentially be a proximate but not a direct cause, and it depends on the definition of proximate. The Court of Appeals, in discussing direct and proximate cause, specifically addressed that there's not much of a distinction to be made there because proximate cause requires a direct act upon the aggrieved in order to create that particular injury. In this particular case, there is not a direct upon this person who's suffering being particularly aggrieved. I would also
What about the relevant and reliable clause in the statute? Would that letter qualify under that? And for the record, I'm looking at Bates 193.
Well, and with respect to Your Honor's question, I would indicate that that would be an analysis that the district court would have had to have undergone. It may or may not have been relevant. However, that's a determination to be made by the district court. And there is nothing in the record to indicate that that analysis was ever completed because the court believed.
And relevant to what? How would you define relevance for purposes, if you were writing an opinion that was to give content to relevance for that statute? What is relevant and what is it relevant to?
Relevance would, it can be construed one of a variety of different ways. With regards to a sentencing, a particular sentencing matter, relevance would be the, I think has been set forth as the impact of the crime on the victim. Directly, the victim's family as defined under the statute, and that goes to the weight of the facts that are to be addressed at sentencing. And that is.
So what about this letter of a coworker where apparently the decedent was like the backbone, the emotional support for the oncology unit, which is a very difficult unit to work in for any nurse or doctor.
specifically, I would purport to say that that's not, that would not fall within the particular relevance of this particular matter, because to do so is to open the door to allow anybody who, as the Court of Appeals addressed it in their questioning, this allows anybody who sees a traumatic event on television, hears about a traumatic event on television, hears about a traumatic event from another person, to then come in and provide a statement as to the effect that it has had on them. Another example would be at that point then allowing, quite frankly, the defendant's family, the defendant's friends to come in and talk about the effect that it has had on them. And that would create a situation where sentencings become much more of an issue of specific opinion, as the state would have said in their argument, a point of view. They're simply stating a point of view. However, this is dealing with the facts that directly underlie the specific offense and the impact that it had on the victim and the victim's family. I would point to Marcy's Law, again, Section 8A of the Nevada Constitution, Section O. And I think it's important here because one of the rights that's guaranteed of a victim of crime is to have the safety of the victim's family, and the general public considered before any parole or other post-judgment release decision is made. That is language specifically written within Marcy's Law that separates a victim's family, and the general public. And in this particular circumstance, an oncology nurse would be the general public and does not follow within the definition of a victim. So under
What do you do with subparagraph 6 of the Marcy's Law section, which says this section does not restrict the authority of the court to consider any reliable and relevant evidence?
Well, and that's the analysis that we're to be conducting. In this particular case, the district court concluded that it must treat them all the same. It puts them within the same pile and that it must be considered, because of the fact that Marcy's Law, in the court's belief, mistakenly would respectfully put forth, Marcy's Law said that anybody who's been affected by the crime would be able to give a statement. And I would point your honors to the Ninth Circuit case of Miller versus Hambrick and the Nevada Supreme Court case of Wilness versus Reno Municipal Court. In Wilness, this court held that a court's failure to exercise its available discretion can itself constitute a manifest abuse of discretion. Additionally, under the Ninth Circuit case of Miller versus Hambrick, that court held a district court's failure to exercise discretion constitutes an abuse of discretion. In a situation like this where the court did not perform that analysis, it would be improper for the Nevada Supreme Court to make a determination or come out with a decision as to whether or not that evidence is relevant and reliable, as the statute puts forth, because the district court omitted that analysis and specifically referenced that it believed it was obligated to admit them all without that analysis.
One follow-up, and I know you're into your... On Bates 319, where the court actually gets around to sentencing, she overrules your objection, and then she gets to the sentencing issue and says, this is the time for sentencing, and I have considered all the information presented, not only in the PSI, but also your statement here in court addressing the defendant. I have certainly considered the statements of the family. And then she says, I've read every letter that was submitted to me, as well as the video and the pictures. Isn't she acknowledging the universe of things she was presented, but emphasizing that what she specifically considered most was the defendant's statement and the statements of the family that were oral, which were the mother and the father of the victims?
Respectively, she may be emphasizing points that she believes may have been more important than others. However, her honor indicates that she's considered it all, and she indicated that she believed that she's required to consider it all.
So you would have had her rule on your objection by saying, I'm going to exclude and not consider specific letters.
Absolutely. And I think that the court of Buschauer kind of set this court in Buschauer set forth that it's important for the district court to make that specific disclaimer so that that analysis can be concluded as to whether or not the letters are being treated as reliable and as relevant and what is not being considered. Because absent that, It's impossible for this court or the Court of Appeals to determine whether or not, quite frankly, to determine whether or not they were considered at sentencing, and that could potentially have a dramatic impact on Mr. Aparicio's rights. With that, I'd ask if Your Honors would please grant me an extra minute to my rebuttal time, given the extra questions.
Your request is granted. Mr. Goodwin, you want to make your argument now?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Charles Goodwin. I represent Amicus Curiae, Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice, who are appearing in support of Mr. Aparicio. Today, we are asking this court to uphold the decision of the Court of Appeals and reverse Mr. Aparicio's sentence. At sentencing, a judge must act as a gatekeeper, screening what evidence can and cannot be considered. Nevada law appropriately requires district courts to consider the views of victims at sentencing. However, for victim evidence to come in, the Victim Bill of Rights and NRS 176.015 create a three-step process. First, the court determines whether a person qualifies as a victim. If they are a victim, they may speak at the sentencing hearing. Second, if they are not a victim, the court must have determined if the evidence is relevant and reliable. And then third, the court considers the evidence as part of its sentencing determination. Here, the district court erred in the first step of this process. Article 1, Section 8A defines victim as a person directly and proximately harmed by the commission of a criminal offense, and in certain circumstances, persons who are appointed to act on the victim's behalf. NRS 176.015, Section 5D, defines victim in a similar manner, but also includes close family members. If somebody does not meet either definition of victim, then the court must determine if the evidence is relevant and reliable. Evidence is relevant and reliable if it relates to the four legitimate goals of penal section, sanctions, retribution, deterrence, incapacitation, and rehabilitation. A district court may properly consider a non-victim's testimony at sentencing only if it finds that evidence to be relevant and reliable. Instead, the district court said that a victim is anyone who is impacted by the crime. On that basis, the court admitted and considered 46 letters from friends, co-workers, and extended family of the deceased victims. This was error. When a sentencing court fails to distinguish between victims and non-victims, the court creates the risk of treating everybody like a victim, such as somebody who did not know the victim but was moved by the story, or even the accused's own family could potentially be classified as victims. This would then grant them all of the victim protections that exist in Article 1, Section 8A of the Nevada Constitution that includes the right to be heard at every hearing, communication with the district attorney, and input on the final sentence. These rights elevate direct victims for special treatment, but treating everyone as a victim prevents giving direct victims the special treatment they deserve. The district court's definition of a victim is unworkable and contrary to what Marcy's Law was meant for. We know the district court erred in this case, so the proper question to ask is whether Mr. Aparicio's sentence was affected by the district court's legal error. And the evidence indicates that the error did affect the sentence. First, the court said that it considered all the letters, and then the court pronounced a sentence that departed from the state's recommendation for concurrent time and exceeded the recommendation contained in the PSI report. Reversal is necessary here. The district court did not exercise its discretion and allowed in everything without doing the statutory or constitutional gatekeeping that is required. As a result, Mr. Aparicio was prejudiced. To find that the letters were not prejudicial enough to affect the sentence, this court would be forced to examine each piece of evidence that came in to discern, first, whether a victim wrote it, second, whether it's relevant and reliable, and then third, what sentence should result. This is not a function that an appellate court is equipped to do and is best left in the hands of a district court judge. NRS 176.015 and Article 1, Section 8A of the Nevada Constitution create a clear framework for how a sentencing hearing is to be conducted. This includes how to identify who is a victim and what information can be considered at the hearing. The court.
Can you give me, let me pause you for just a moment. In your estimation, what would be a non-victim letter that is relevant and reliable to sentencing? Can you give me an example, whether from the universe of letters in this case or just in general?
Sure. So I want to be clear, relevant and reliable, we do believe those are terms of art. And we're saying that they need to have some relation to retribution, deterrence, incapacitation, and rehabilitation, and a foundational knowledge of that in relation to the actual case. So there's a very good chance that many of the letters may have come in, or they may not. Our contention is that that's the definition that would work, but at the first part, that the district court never did any sort of analysis on these types of letters in the first place, so we're not clear whether or not the evidence is relevant and reliable.
But to put some meat on the bones of this, take the oncology ward co-worker, would that be relevant and reliable when they're saying this woman was extraordinary and her loss has gravely affected our delivery of services?
I think that it might come in, but I think that that's something that the district court itself needs to do the analysis on first. Okay. I don't think any analysis was done, and all of them were considered. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to end, this includes how to identify who was a victim and what information could be considered at the hearing. Court abuses discretion and did not work within that framework. When it comes to liberty, the judge must get it right. A new sentencing hearing is required. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin, for your argument. Mr. Chen, you've got double duty today. We're working you overtime. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Alexander Chen, on behalf of the state of Nevada. Contrary to what the appellant had mentioned in this, the state isn't arguing for every single person to be treated as a victim, as they're trying to say. We know what the statutes are when it comes to 176.015, and there's an interpretation to be made with Marcy's Law. But those are two different things, and historically, the court has always allowed sentencing courts to be the gatekeeper of information that it's going to consider. My problem with the Court of Appeals decision in this particular case is that it said the district court erred by considering the impact from non-victim, or at least people who wouldn't be defined by statute or Marcy's Law, that it considered those things without giving some type of individualized attention as to whether or not they are defined as a victim, and then what type of weight it was going to provide. From a purely functional standpoint, that would be nearly impossible to do. I know that...
Wait, Mr. Chen, I'm sorry. What is a district court judge to do when there is an objection on the record? Aren't they to make findings at that point?
I understand, Justice Silver, and I think that she did make reasonable findings in stating that she had reviewed the letters, and the letters were going to be permissible, at least under Marcy's Law. And I remind this court, this wasn't a fact of having an actual person come to court and be able to testify. The only two individuals that testified in this case were specifically the parents of the deceased, or at least the parents of one of the deceased.
Mr. Chen, I apologize, but this is Justice Cater. So I want to understand the state's position clearly then, in light of what you just said. Are you saying that each one of these letters is from a victim, either under the statute or under Marcy's Law?
No, Justice Kadish,
okay.
That wasn't what we were saying.
Okay.
What I'm trying to say is that these letters should have been admissible, even if the district court said, and maybe erroneously said, impacted by crime, because that's not what Marcy's Law says, and I'm not going to say that that's what Marcy's Law says.
Right.
However, historically, the district court has always been capable of assessing individual information, and NRS 176.015 subsection 6 is the catch-all that you can consider any relevant and reliable information. And the issue that I have with the Court of Appeals opinion is that it basically terms anyone who's not directly called a victim, either by statute or by Marcy's Law, that is inherently either irrelevant or unreliable. And that's what is inherently wrong about the Court of Appeals opinion, is that there's nothing in the record to indicate that any of the letters, whether they're from colleagues, whether they're from distant relatives, whether they're from people who only knew the parents and have seen the impact that the crime has had on those parents, there's no indication that any of that is irrelevant to what this case was about.
Well, Mr. Chen, just to the point of relevance, relevance depends upon the proposition that's to be proven or what we're trying to resolve. So we're trying to resolve what is the appropriate sentence for a defendant. So how is a letter from a non-victim, or in this case, we had some from people who didn't even know the victim, how is that relevant to what sentence the defendant should get?
Because this is something that the district court can consider, but just because an individual doesn't know the actual victims themselves doesn't mean that they aren't affected by crime or that they don't have an opinion as to what the crime is. And ultimately, in the letters that were written in this case, the judge was able to determine how close of a connection the individuals had.
But how would we know that from this record? Because the judge gave kind of a bulk admission of the records and didn't go through those letters each and let us know which ones were objected to, which ones were relevant, which ones weren't.
Well, I think ultimately it's a totality of what the judge said that was considered. And ultimately, unless the judge were required to go through each letter, all 50 of them, to personally identify which ones were going to be considered, which ones were not, what portions of those letters would be considered and not, because the Court of Appeals also had an issue with the fact that, as you mentioned, Justice Stiglitz, what relevance does a recommendation have from a person who's not a victim? Well, for instance, if a public official were taking bribes, for instance, I would assume that the public might write the judge a number of letters. They're not necessarily directly impacted or proximately and directly harmed by this individual accepting bribes. However, as an interested person, they very well might say, Judge, you should not be lenient on this person because of the fact that they've done something that's so horrendous. So just because they're not defined as an actual victim under statute or Marcy's law, I don't think it makes it irrelevant that an individual might give an opinion as to what the sentence should actually be.
Then what
but
would
at
the
end of the
But then what would the gatekeeping function? There is no gatekeeping function under that example. I mean, isn't the state's role to represent the state and kind of the state's interest in what's the appropriate sentence? And then the victim, per Marcy's law, per statute, has also an independent voice that's given to them to talk to that?
Absolutely, Justice. And that's why victims that are actually for instance, someone defined in 176.015 are given specific rights in which that they can exercise at a sentencing. Other things would fall into the catch-all provision of subsection 6, where the judge will give it whatever determination it feels appropriate. But I do think that the judge is capable of being the gatekeeper of this information, and basically that judge shouldn't have to necessarily go through something specific unless it's clearly objectionable, which in this particular case...
Mr. Chen, but if there was an objection, for example, to 50 photographs being irrelevant, you would expect that district court judge to go through the pictures and to put on the record its ruling, why it's relevant, why it's not relevant. Why would this be any different if there's an objection made, whether it's Marcy's law or relevance? Wouldn't you expect the district court judge, like any other piece of evidence under an objection, to make that record, especially for appellate review?
Justice Silver, in terms of your question, I think it would depend in part on whether we were talking about a trial or whether we were talking about a sentencing. Sentencing isn't an entire trial, so I wouldn't expect the record to be as detailed as if I was trying to admit 50 photographs in the guilt phase of a trial. I think that there's some distinction to be made there.
Why? Why is there an objection? Isn't sentencing just as important to a person's liberty that the district court get the correct sentence and only consider what it should consider for sentencing purposes?
And if there was something, Justice, that was incredibly objectionable, I might understand that. But, for instance, this court has reversed cases where the judge relied upon something that wasn't in the record, for instance, thinking that somebody was doing something terroristic-like, and there was no foundation to believe that the defendant had any dealings with mass shootings or terrorism or anything like that. Here, what we're talking about are people who knew the individuals that were impacted one way or another, and that the court essentially looked at everything. So even under your analysis, Justice Silver, if you think that the district court judge should have gone through every single photo, it would be incredibly harmless in this case because there's not one thing that was objectionable about the sentence that was received. It was a tough case. Two people were killed. There was another passenger that was injured. The sentence range obviously could vary by a lot. The district court judge felt it appropriate to give higher sentence based upon what happened in this case. but it's within the statutory means of doing so. And so for that, it just doesn't, that there's nothing other than a harmless error if you believe that any error was committed.
So, Mr. Chen, what in the record would lead us to be able to point to and say, okay, maybe these aren't all victims under the statute or the Constitution, but they're all relevant? What could we look to in the record and say, the judge did her job, she'd made that analysis, and we should affirm?
Because every letter that was written had to do with the victims in this case or their families. For instance, opposing counsel mentioned the Buschauer case and was talking about Buschauer protecting their rights and ensuring that the courts make sure the only proper information is gathered. But Buschauer is incredibly different from this. In that case, it was about whether a victim could talk about prior acts of a defendant. Now, that obviously implicates incredibly different rights, and that's where the court in Buschauer kind of said, if that's going to happen, there might need to be some notice given to the defense they're going to talk about this.
Was there any mention of relevance during this sentencing? Was there any discussion or analysis of whether these letters were relevant?
Well, I think in figuring that they were letters, victim impact type letters, I think that right there says it's relevant, because knowing about the victims and the harm, that's part of the reason of sentencing. Obviously, the other end of that is hearing the defendant's point of view and things that might have happened to the defendant. But as I was mentioning in Buschauer, in that case, they were talking about swearing in the victim, subjecting the victim to cross-examination, because we were talking about the defendant's potential rights, talking about bad acts and prior acts.
How many of these letters would qualify as victims under Marcy's law or the statute?
I would think nearly almost all of them, because I would say that when it comes to the employees, they were approximately and directly harmed. I would say for the family members, including cousins and whatnot, they might not have been defined by 176.015, but it was clear from the letters that they had very close relationship with the victims. Many of them were childhood friends. And the problem, I guess, even maybe beyond this case and on the outside, is the statute obviously has very specific definitions for individuals, and I understand why, but to think that only certain type of nuclear families or certain type of definitions that are traditional to our notions would apply seems to be incredibly unfair. What about an individual who, I mean, and I would say maybe with regards to this case, the letters written by cousins would be a perfect example of that. They might be cousins by blood, but it sure seems like from the letters that they're siblings or that they're just like immediate family. And to treat them as either irrelevant or unreliable simply because they don't attain the status of the statute doesn't seem to give a fair perspective to the victims and the pain that they're suffering from the results of these crimes. Part of what the Court of Appeals did, though, was they did put this evidentiary requirement on sentencings. And I think that that's incredibly problematic, especially in light of Buschauer and the statute. Because, for instance, what is a court to rely on? Where does the court draw the line when it comes to evidentiary requirements at a sentencing? If, for instance, a defendant is explaining the defendant's background, problems, substance abuse issues, anything on behalf of the defendant, would we expect that to be independently verified as reliable and relevant? Certainly it's relevant, but where does the court know that that information is reliable?
But the court can determine what weight to give that information as it relates to the sentencing of the defendant. But it is the defendant that is being sentenced.
I was just going to say, I don't see how that varies from the letters that it received.
Because the statute provides who can provide evidence in that fashion. The statute puts those guardrails up. And then the catch-all kind of is this relevant and reliable. And so the question to you is the court going to exercise that gatekeeping function for the things that don't meet the statute or not? It seems like you're advocating they shouldn't.
I think only for highly impalpable and suspect evidence, as this court has found in Silks v. State, that's when the court would exercise its function of keeping information out.
Shouldn't the district court be the one going through the letters? Why should we be going through letters in the first instance for us to decide what's impalpable evidence? Shouldn't the district court in the first instance go through these and make a record about what qualifies as a victim letter under the statute, because those go in one pile, those are easy, and then the court has to say why are these groupings of letters relevant and reliable and thus subject to my consideration? Why is that too high of a bar?
Certainly, I guess I would say that it doesn't hurt when a record is more developed, as you're indicating. Certainly, I suppose if a court were to have done that, then maybe we wouldn't be reviewing this in the first instance. But because we are reviewing at this time, I would say that you'd still have to go under a plain error, harmless error analysis. And based upon all of the evidence in this particular case, it just doesn't seem that the court relied upon anything highly suspect or impalpable, which is what this court has always held when it comes to sentencings, that information would be prohibited. So ultimately, our position that the court, we entrust our courts to do the right thing. We entrust our courts to not rely upon highly suspect evidence. We entrust our courts to make fair sentencing decisions. But instead, in this particular case, the Court of Appeals reversed that sentence, despite the fact that obviously the victims had an incredible impact and their loss has incredibly impacted the families, friends, and the workers involved. And so for that, there's simply no reason to vacate this sentence. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Sheets, you have, I believe, a minute and 51 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let's see how quickly I can work. I would like to start off by indicating that it sure certainly appears that the state is conceding a material issue here. When asked by Madam Justice, the response from the state was that if there was more of a record, this would be helpful. This is exactly the concern that is posed here, because there is no record of that analysis having been conducted. And without that analysis...
But Mr. Sheets, in your objection was, and I'll read it, it's that the victim impact statements should not be considered because the individuals listed don't meet the statutory definition of victims or relatives. That was what your objection was. So that's, you didn't right. ask for a determination, and even if they weren't victims or relatives, it was irrelevant, or, I mean, it's not surprising given the way this was structured, but you got what you want because, or you got what you did because the way the objection went, You're essentially saying unless they're a victim or a relative, their statement can't be considered. Well, that's not true if it's relevant or reliable. And so nobody prompted the court to do more. I mean, I'm a little troubled by the record from both sides on this case.
Well, and I will respectfully put forth that the defense raised an objection. There is not a rebuttal that says these fall within the catch-all provision, and then that court never made that analysis. The district court never put on the record. There is, I believe as the state said, nothing in the record that indicates that the court even did that analysis under the catch-all provision. In fact, the court specifically stated, Article 1, Section 8 of the Nevada Constitution broadly defines victim as anyone who's impacted by the crime. That was the rationale. With the court's permission, could I have one additional minute?
Yes, but that's it.
Thank you, Your Honor. So based on that, it seems apparent that the district court did not exercise its discretion to conduct that analysis because it believed it did not have that discretion to conduct that particular analysis. And interestingly enough, the state makes the concession that maybe the district court erroneously stated that anyone impacted by the crime. What we have not heard here today is the state propose a reason why these letters or how these letters would have fallen within a definition that fits within Marcy's law as victims, as in making a blank statement. While the appellant in this particular circumstance has delineated exactly why he would not fall in as a victim. What's important for your honors to realize is that in order for your honors to conduct a harmless error analysis, you must conclude that there was error. And because there is no record, it would then require your honors to do a factual analysis for the first time as to the reliability and relevance of the evidence. And for your honors, by your honors' precedence, that cannot be done at this level. We would ask the sentencing be reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sheet. Mr. Chen, we appreciate your arguments here today. And Mr. Goodwin, we thank you and the association for offering your viewpoint for this matter. The case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess.